Hey friends, just quickly, my new book, The Proof is in the Plants, is now available. Get it from plantproof.com/book. Thanks so much for all your ongoing support, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
About 10, 12% of people will have kidney stones. People say, oh, you know, Dr. Joshi, he had a kidney stone. He eats a plant-based diet. I shouldn't eat plant-based. I actually had a kidney stone when I was not on a plant-based diet. I was in high school. I was thinking about trying out for a football team. Coach said, oh, you need to gain some weight so you can we can put you on. So he was like, oh, eat a bunch of these TV dinners. Have a lot of protein, a lot of fat. You'll gain some weight. We can maybe put you on. That's what I did. I ate a lot of these TV dinners. And it was only until years later that I realized why that would give me a kidney stone. Those foods are extremely high in sodium. And they're also, at the time, I was not plant-based, so I was eating a lot of animal protein. Those two things, eating a lot of salt and a lot of animal protein, contributes to the formation of a stone. And the third thing, being that I was in Florida, which is hot, I wasn't drinking enough water. So hydration.
That's nephrologist Dr. Shivam Joshi. And this is episode 103 of the Plant Proof Podcast. Hey friends, hope you're doing well today. Welcome back to another episode of the Plant Proof Podcast. My name's Simon Hill, I'm your host, and by way of background, I have a bachelor's degree in physiotherapy, a master's in nutrition, and really a passion for separating fact from fiction when it comes to how our food choices affect our health and the planet's. I started this show to create a safe space, a non-judgmental space to talk about diet. My aim is to separate any ideology from science. And then with that information, you can make decisions in your own life that suit the lifestyle you want to lead. A here's the information approach rather than here's what you must do. Most weeks, if I'm not doing a solo episode, I sit down with incredible guests from all over the world, doctors, nutritionists, dietitians, etc., to bring you the agenda-free information to upgrade your health. And today's no different. I was super fortunate to have dinner and record a podcast with Dr. Shivam Joshi when I recently was in New York. Shivam is a nephrologist, which means he specializes in all things kidney related, and in particular, kidney disease, which is the focus of this episode, a topic that I haven't covered on this show before, which is really interesting. To preface this conversation, I dug up a few statistics on kidney disease, both locally in Australia and globally. Here in Australia, 42% of people over 75 have an indicator of chronic kidney disease, and 10% of all people visiting their general practitioner in Australia have chronic kidney disease but don't know it. Globally, 10% of the entire population, or nearly 800 million people, have chronic kidney disease, killing millions of people each year. The good news, though, like many chronic diseases, chronic kidney disease can be avoided with lifestyle changes and even reversed if detected early and managed appropriately. In this episode, you will learn about the role of the kidneys, what kidney disease is, who's at risk, the complications of kidney disease, the stages of kidney disease, and a bunch more. So with that said, pen out, no pads open, or simply find a quiet place and get ready to explore the fascinating area of medicine that is nephrology. Here's Dr. Shivam Joshi and I, recording just days before New York City went into lockdown. Shivam Joshi, welcome to the Plant Proof Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Did I get that right?
I wasn't even listening. I was more...
Shivam Joshi, man. I think...
Shivam Joshi. We didn't work on the last
name. We didn't work on that enough, yeah. But excuse me for that. But it's got to be the coolest name among all of the MDs out there, right?
Yeah.
Wow. In New York, we had dinner last night. What a time to be alive. It's interesting, isn't it?
It is very interesting. About to get a lot more interesting.
You work at Bellevue Hospital, right?
That's correct.
So you, same hospital as Michelle.
Exactly.
Okay, who's been on the show a few times. What's the feeling like down at the hospital, sort of with the patients you're seeing and amongst your colleagues?
Yeah, I think the feeling is the same as many other people are feeling, except that we work in the healthcare field. So it's a little bit of panic, but also combined with realizing that this is our job and we have to do our best to contain it and not panic. So it's a lot of mixed emotions.
What's it look like, I guess, specifically for you? You're a nephrologist, so I'm assuming that you have regular patients that come and see you for kidney-related issues, right?
For kidney-related issues and also primary care issues as
and
well.
And primary care. So at the moment, you're seeing your regular patients, or are you seeing anyone who comes in with sort of flu-like symptoms?
We're actually not seeing any patients right now. So we were as of Thursday, but because of the virus, we don't want the virus to be spreading in our waiting rooms to staff, from someone who may be in our staff who doesn't know it yet to a patient. So we're trying to minimize the spread in general. So we're doing telephone visits, just calling patients up, seeing how they're doing.
How do you sort of see this playing out across the USA from what you understand to date about spread in other countries and what this virus is like?
I think this is very new. It's hard to even realize what we're going through. This will be one of those moments that defines a generation, kind of like the 1918 flu, if what predictions are saying are correct. This has the potential to be a lot worse than it was in China or Korea, where they took authoritarian measures, did a lot of quarantine. But here, it could spread far and wide.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
It's crazy. I mean, like we were talking about last night, and it's happening around the world. There's videos of hand sanitizers running out and toilet paper. That must be scary from a hospital point of view if any of the supplies get limited.
Yeah. So we're definitely being stretched to the limit, not just our hospital, but every hospital out there in terms of critical things, even ventilators, bed space, supplies. Yeah, what people see in their lives is what's happening also, you know, with hospitals too. We have to be mindful and ration things.
Yeah. So chronic kidney disease, or CKD, that's exactly how it's abbreviated, right?
Exactly. That's the lingo.
I haven't explored this at all on the show in nearly 100 episodes. So it's a pleasure to sit down with you today so we can go through it from the sort of CKD 101 level and learn more about it and understand who's affected by this disease, what the risk factors are, how things like diet play into risk factor or managing the disease,
right?
All that stuff. So thank you for joining me. Perhaps we start by understanding how you developed a passion in the first place for this sort of specialty area of medicine.
Yeah, so my passion started in medical school. And coming into medical school, I was like many medical students. I didn't know what I wanted to go into. And I thought, let me look around and see what's the most exciting thing. The usual things did not appeal to me. So cancer research or treating heart disease. And what really appealed to me was taking an organ from someone else and putting it into someone else's body. It's almost like recycling, which I've always recycled in my life, but this was like a new twist on it, except this has huge implications for someone who may have two kidneys or maybe pass away, unfortunately, and then you take their kidney and put it in someone else. So I got into kidney transplantation. I did a lot of research in medical school. I thought I was going to be a transplant surgeon, but the hours are brutal. So I shied away from that and thought I was going to be a transplant nephrologist. So the distinction means, you know, that the surgeon takes the kidney out, puts it in, and the transplant nephrologist kind of does the medical aspect before and after, who gets one, treating it, complications, things like that. And so I went through my training. I did an internal medicine residency, and then I did a nephrology fellowship afterwards. And then at that point, I was deciding between going into transplant nephrology or stopping with the training that I had done there. And I stopped and I didn't continue going into transplant nephrology because during this process, I also realized that the number one, number two causes of kidney disease and kidney failure are diabetes and high blood pressure, respectively, at least in the United States.
Which are very, very prevalent.
prevalent and also preventable.
That's it. So you felt you could make more impact there.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that kind of turned the ship for me. That's when I started to change course. And I thought, maybe instead of treating things after the fact, maybe we should start focusing on preventing disease, and we wouldn't have to worry about who gets a kidney and why aren't there enough kidneys to go around, and why are so many people on dialysis and people dying on dialysis. So it's almost like the coronavirus, better to prevent the disease, you know, with hand sanitizer and washing and social isolation, as opposed to treating it after the fact.
And would you say sort of historically, and then maybe not even historically, if you sort of look just across the globe and across America and the way patients with chronic kidney disease are managed, is it very much it's a reactive, let's just manage the disease? Is there a whole lot of prevention programs out there for this?
No, they're definitely not. It's very reactive, unfortunately, and for different reasons too. In the United States, it's reactive because that's how our health system is set up. It's set up to treat things after effect. There has been a shift towards preventing disease and outcomes, and towards kidney disease, we're making small improvements. And outside of the United States, especially in third world countries, people just don't have the means to get tested.
So when you say tested, you're speaking to sort of pre-screening and identifying people that are at risk, people that have hypertension or are sort of pre-diabetic.
Exactly.
At that stage, intervening.
Exactly. Yeah. So if the number one and number two cause are diabetes and high blood pressure, and people who've had, you know, these diseases uncontrolled, have had it for a long time, should definitely be tested. And especially in countries that don't have a lot of healthcare resources, are not being tested.
Do you think a lot of patients with hypertension or with diabetes understand that this is a common complication of those diseases?
I don't think so. I think kidney disease is underrated. I think some people may know about it if they unfortunately have a friend or family member who's been on dialysis and understands that. But in our minds, we're more concerned about cancer and heart disease, which are both diseases that deserve focus and our understanding, but kidney disease kind of gets pushed to the back burner. There should be more attention to that.
How many, and we're going to define our terms in a minute, but at a high level, how many people with diabetes develop chronic kidney disease?
It's about a third.
Wow, yeah. That's a lot.
It is a lot of people.
Because like diabetes itself, it's other complications that end up killing someone with diabetes, right? Such
yeah.
as you mentioned cardiovascular disease.
Exactly.
But kidney disease can also result in death.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's the thing. So for people who know about kidney disease, who have made that link and understand that I'm at risk for kidney disease or I have kidney disease, their biggest fear is actually not death. It's dialysis. It's literally a ball and chain, and they have every right to be afraid of it. But what people don't understand is that most people with kidney disease actually die before they progress to dialysis. And that's the even scarier part.
There's different stages, right? We'll go through that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So perhaps here's a good time to
talk about that.
Yeah. Just to define some of our terms, right?
Yeah.
So let's just go from sort of the 101 level.
Yeah.
What are the kidneys? Where are they located?
Yeah.
Why are they so important?
Yeah.
And then let's move into sort of the pathology of chronic kidney disease.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone, for the most part, has two kidneys. And they're organs. They're about the size of a fist, maybe a little bit bigger. They sit in your back, kind of in your flank areas on both sides, left and right side. And
both are doing the same thing?
Both are doing the same thing.
Because am I right that you can live with just one?
Exactly. You can live with just one. And that's why some people donate a kidney to a friend or a family member or coworker. So in health, the kidneys are what they do. They help excrete toxins. They help regulate how much potassium, sodium, calcium you have in your blood. They regulate all the minerals and the water content in your body. A good way to think of it is that everything that you drink gets peed out in your urine. When the kidneys don't work, imagine all that urine not being made. Imagine it just accumulating in your body day after day. And that can happen to a varying extent. So that can happen slowly, or if you're on dialysis, that happens, you know, abruptly on a day-to-day basis until you get dialysis again. So that's a good way to think about it. So when you're dehydrated, you may notice that your urine is darker, and all that yellow stuff are the toxins that you see in your urine. And then when you're more hydrated, your urine may become more dilute, but your body is diluting the urine and putting out more urine because it doesn't need all that extra water. So that's a kind of a good way to understand and see what your kidneys do on a day-to-day basis.
And on top of, I mean, you mentioned there sort of the filtering of the toxins and regulating that fluid. They're also involved in the production of hormones. Is that right?
Exactly. So the kidneys do produce a few hormones. Probably the most important one is a hormone that makes blood. So people with kidney failure who don't really have working kidneys need this hormone injected or supplied intravenously to them so they can make blood.
And then chronic kidney disease, so that pathology, what is happening at a sort of cellular level and how does that progress over time?
Yeah, so we should probably go back a little bit and do a little bit of a history. So before we knew about chronic kidney disease, people just called it Bright's disease. And I had a Spanish teacher who had a grandfather who had Bright's disease. So if you ask your relatives and, you know, they may say, oh, I knew someone who had Bright's disease. That's because we didn't really have a good understanding of what it was. We just termed it this blanket term and then eventually got termed into...
So how were these people presenting and being managed back then?
Very late. They were presenting with basically kidney failure. There weren't tests to diagnose.
Kidney failure is the end stage?
The final...
Of chronic kidney disease.
Exactly.
How does that... I'm asking probably some silly questions here, but
no.
There's... different terminology used by different people, right?
Yeah.
So renal disease,
yeah.
Is that the same as chronic kidney disease?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
And end stage renal disease is
the last stage.
Kidney failure.
Exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of terms thrown around. So sometimes people use renal insufficiency, renal disease, chronic kidney disease. They all mean the same thing, that you have some sort of kidney problem. There've been attempts to standardize the terminology, and the most common a framework that we use is the stages, the five stages of kidney disease. So there's stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, stage five, and they progress according to basically the percent kidney function that you have. So you can roughly approximate your kidney function as 100% and then going down to zero. And you're born, let's say, with 100% kidney function.
How are they measuring that with some sort of biomarkers like blood tests?
Blood test. So if you've ever had routine blood work, you can actually go track down your blood work. And more often than not, you've had a test for your kidney function. And that test is called the creatinine test. And that creatinine test gets plugged into a formula based on your age, gender, things like that. And you can get information on how your kidneys are functioning. And that gives you a number. And that number roughly approximates your percent kidney function. It's off a little bit, but for you know, broad sweeping purposes, we can kind of understand percent kidney function based according to that. And as your kidney function declines, you progress through the stages from stage one to stage two to stage three. So by the time you're at stage three, you're down to 60 or 45% kidney function. The technical term is milliliters per minute adjusted to body surface area, 1.73 meters squared. But when you're at stage three, you've roughly lost about half of your kidney function. And then...
So someone has the risk factors. The biggest risk factors are a type 2 diabetes or any diabetes?
Any
diabetes. Yeah. And what specifically about the diabetes is increasing the risk factor for chronic kidney disease?
It damages the blood vessels of the kidney. So the kidney is kind of like this delicate instrument, and it's sensitive to changes in pressure, which is why blood pressure damages, but also the amount of sugar in the blood, amount of glucose. And that glucose also damages the blood vessels, the filtration membrane in the kidney, the filter component of the kidney, and it ultimately leads to scarring,
okay,
fibrosis. So loss of function.
And so about 30% of people with diabetes will get chronic kidney disease.
Of some form.
But if you look at the population with chronic kidney disease,
yeah,
how many of them have diabetes? It must be a very high percentage.
Yeah. So a large number of people have diabetes. Most of those people have pre-diabetes and then a fraction of those have diabetes. So it's important for people who have prediabetes to be tested and to be treated so they don't go on to develop diabetes.
So I guess a better way for me to have asked that question was, are there many people without prediabetes or diabetes that develop chronic kidney disease?
Yes, there are a number of people, but by far and away, diabetes and hypertension take the bulk. And after that, you get other cases of people getting kidney disease. So these would be like, for example, lupus. Lupus can cause kidney disease. There's other diseases. They're called glomerular nephropathies, IgA nephropathy, membranous, minimal change, things like that. And even bad infections. So going back to the coronavirus, that can, we think, cause kidney disease too. Most severe infections. So if you're one of those fortunate people that has coronavirus, ends up in the ICU, just having a bad infection can cause your kidneys to stop working and cause damage to the kidney.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got these risk factors, predisposes someone to chronic kidney disease. You mentioned that there's these stages, which we've discovered in the last how many decades? Fairly recently.
Yeah, maybe like the past 50 years or so.
So what's that progression like in terms of timing? So from if you're in stage one, how long would it take typically to end at complete sort of end stage renal disease?
Yeah, so it definitely depends on the underlying cause. So it depends on what is damaging your kidney and how fast that damage is occurring. So there are some diabetics out there that are losing maybe 5% kidney function per year. And if they're starting out at 50%, you know, within a decade, they could end up on dialysis or sooner. There's other people who are progressing very slowly that they may have kidney disease and they're in their 70s, but they'll likely outlive any need for dialysis. So it depends.
Okay, so talk me through these stages. Is there any science or evidence from your experience? Can you slow down the progression between stages for someone? And is there any way to actually reverse it?
Yeah, so there are definitely ways to slow down the progression. So certainly if you have diabetes and you get rid of your diabetes, we have some evidence that you can actually reverse the type of kidney disease that you have from the diabetes. And in terms of slowing it down, we do have medications to slow it down. So these are, physicians call them ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers. These types of medications are used for people who have a lot of protein in their urine, specifically patients who have diabetes, and it can slow down the rate of progression of your kidney. So instead of losing 5% of your kidney function a year, they can slow it down to maybe 1% or 2% of kidney function per year. And when I say percent, what I'm really trying to say is the glomerular filtration rate, the GFR. So if you have blood work done, you can go look this up yourself. You can look on the blood work and you'll see it says like a number, it says creatinine. That number gets plugged into a formula, like I said, and then it gives you a GFR. And that GFR is the amount of kidney function that you have. And you can lose that with having diabetes or high blood pressure. So if you have...
That will increase, is that right?
If you have, that number will decrease. Yeah. And that's reflecting loss of your kidney function. That number, you want it to be higher is better, lower is worse. And it's confusing because the creatinine number, a lower number is better, but a higher is worse. So creatinine is a measure of how much of the byproducts of metabolism are accumulating in your body. So that creatinine number, you want lower, which reflects a higher filtration or filtering
capacity. You're clearing more.
Exactly.
Yeah. But then on the other one?
With the filtration measure, a lower number means that you're clearing less.
And what's that going to show up on the blood test, the abbreviation for that?
GFR.
GFR.
Glomerular filtration rate.
Sure.
Yeah. The reason it's called that is because it's the amount of blood being filtered at the glomerulus. Glomerulus is a component of the nephron of the kidney, which is how nephrologists get their name.
So when in your sort of clinical experience, if you see someone... Let's say they have type 2 diabetes and you help them get on top of that. They lose some weight. They become more insulin sensitive. Do you notice changes in these biomarkers on the blood tests?
Yeah, definitely. You can definitely alter your course by changing how bad your blood pressure, how bad your diabetes is, and whether you take medications and what you do in your own lifestyle.
What is it with blood pressure? We went through diabetes. Specifically, how is the high blood pressure affecting the kidneys?
It's the actual pressure. So if you think of having a sensitive, delicate instrument, like those CD players from the 90s, you know, if you went running with them, they would skip. They were very delicate. They can't really tolerate a lot of movement or damage. The filtration unit in the kidney is actually sensitive as well, kind of like that. So a high or low blood pressure will result in damage. Low blood pressure leads to low oxygen in the kidney, which leads to damage, which is what happens in severe infections where people are in sepsis in the ICU, which may be what we're about to see with the coronavirus, unfortunately, in the coming weeks. And with high blood pressure, that pressure is actually damaging the filtration unit of the kidney, and that leads to scarring. The kidney cannot handle that elevated blood pressure.
Is that filtration unit, is that the nephrons? Is that exactly the part of the kidney?
Exactly. So each person has about 1 million nephrons in each kidney. It's what they're born with. And over time, they lose it through natural aging or through developing diabetes, high blood pressure. Another big cause of kidney disease is taking a specific type of pain reliever. So it's NSAIDs like ibuprofen, naproxen, things like that. So when you see those commercials on TV, they'll say, you know, use caution if you have chronic kidney disease or high blood pressure, because those medications can raise blood pressure, and which can cause kidney disease, but they can also cause kidney disease themselves when used in excess. Not if you use it every now and then for a backache or, you know, a knee injury or something like that, you're probably fine. But the person that's using it habitually several times a day over many years, those people can put themselves in jeopardy.
And we'll definitely zoom in on protein at some stage when we start talking about diet.
Yeah.
You mentioned it before then in the urine. As we're sort of talking about the progression of this disease, it's probably good for us to go over dialysis.
Yeah.
I think most people have heard of it.
Yeah.
But what is involved? What is a patient essentially signing up for when they have to start dialysis? And how is dialysis helping manage chronic kidney disease?
Yeah. So, to go back to the stages, so you have the five stages of kidney disease. So if you look at that GFR number, stage one is that you have some early signs of kidney disease. Your GFR is greater than 90. Stage two is between 90 and 60. Stage three is between 60 and 30. Stage three gets divided into two stages, A and B, but it's between 60 and 30. And then between 30 and 15 is stage four, which is when you have fairly severe kidney disease, you're starting to notice that you're not making perhaps as much urine. Some of this fluid that you're taking in, the water, tea, coffee, gets accumulating in your legs. And then at stage five is when your GFR is below 15 mLs per minute. And that's when we're talking to patients about, well, actually a little bit before, even at the end of stage four, we're starting to talk to patients about what happens next. Are you interested in a transplant, dialysis, things like that? And so stage five is less than 15 mLs per minute, or about less than 15% of kidney function. You can get by with it. And I've seen people go down to as low as 5% before they need to start dialysis. When someone needs to start dialysis is highly variable. It depends on their body's needs and their life and things like that. But most people between 7 and about 11 mLs per minute, or 7 and 11% of kidney function, need to start dialysis. And when you get to that point, you have to make a hard decision, which is, how are you going to keep living with kidney failure? Do you have a friend or a family member that likes you enough, literally, to give you a kidney? Or are you in a position that you unfortunately don't have someone that could donate a kidney? Maybe they have kidney problems or they're too sick to donate a kidney.
What are the criteria to receive a kidney from someone else?
If you're in that position and you need a kidney, you have to not have cancer. There's certain criteria that you know, you can't have a disease process that will shorten your life if you otherwise received a kidney. So you don't want to have terminal cancer and then you get a kidney and then you and the kidney go with it, because then the kidney could have gone to someone else who could have had more years with it. Severe infection, because you'll be taking these medications to lower your immune system. A big risk with transplantation is that your body could fight the kidney, especially if it's from someone who is different or not related to you. And
is that common?
It is. It's in various stages. It is common, but our medications are getting better. So we're testing people better. We're trying to match them better. And the medications we're using are better. So there are people who live 10, 20 years with a kidney and they do fine. They've gotten the kidney from someone else, a family member or someone or even a friend, and it's been matched according to their particularities of their body. In order to donate a kidney, you have to be healthy yourself. You can't have kidney problems. You can't have risk factors for kidney disease. You have to understand the risks involved with it. So there's a process to be evaluated. The risk
being that you only need one kidney, but if something else happens to that, you no longer have a backup.
Right. It's not so that you don't have a backup. There are things in place, and the transplant community is working towards making it easier and protecting donors. It's just that you have to treat that kidney very well. You know, you have to be diligent and not make sure you're not overdoing those medications that like those pain relievers that put your kidneys at risk.
Is there any data on that in terms of, because I guess just thinking out loud here, you've got two kidneys.
Yeah.
Sort of, they're both filtering 50% of what's going through your body.
Yeah.
When you shift to one, are you overloading that? And sort of in the long run, how's the health of that kidney compared to having had two kidneys your whole life?
You are putting that kidney to work. So if you think about your kidney function, the kidneys are working 50% on the left side, 50% on the right side in general. And you donate a kidney, say, to a family member who needs it because they unfortunately need a kidney. That one kidney will then ramp up its function to a certain extent. It won't replace 100% of function, but it may go up to 70 or 80%, depending on how healthy and young you are. And that will be enough for you to get by, assuming nothing else happens for the duration of one's lifetime. So there's a little bit of variability. The kidney can respond. It can adapt a little bit.
Yeah, I know. I'm just thinking, we're digressing here, but I know there was a famous Australian footballer who had a collision injury and actually had one of his kidneys removed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it was a bit of a decision for him to go, okay, am I going to go back and play with one kidney?
Right.
Where I could also end up it was a freak accident. It obviously doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah.
But there is a heightened risk if you were to have a sort of collision again and you only have the one kidney.
Yeah. So that is a risk that does happen. What happened there, most likely, I don't know the specifics of that. You see this a lot with people in car accidents who were just sustained a lot of trauma, is that you sustained a blow to your flank area, your back, and you've had some bleeding in the kidney. What happens is that the bleeding kind of compresses the kidney or causes the kidney to stop functioning, and then the kidney dies, unfortunately, or you may need to have the kidney removed to stop the bleeding so you yourself don't die. That may be the case in what happened in that footballer. If you donate a kidney and then you yourself are in a position where you are in kidney failure, there are, at least in the United States, there are policies in place that you would get priority in making sure that you get a kidney first.
So they're protected.
You're protected. Yeah. You won't, there are things in place that you won't, you know, assuming that you meet all the requirements, that you know you won't go to the back of the line or beyond dialysis.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, so we want to reduce that burden and give people that protection, so they're encouraged to donate a kidney. And that's the thing. The reason people need a kidney is because there's so many people on dialysis, and not everyone can get a kidney. There's actually a huge wait list, and that wait list has grown over the years. So, for example, if you're in the New York area, you could wait 5 to 7 years to get a kidney on the wait list. So the wait list means is you don't have a friend or a family member to donate a kidney.
And if you're on dialysis, what's the sort of average survival rate from when you get to that stage?
So the survival rate is rather dismal. So say you are that for all comers, it's about 42, 45% at 5 years. So most people on dialysis 5 years later actually die rather than are still being alive. It's not because dialysis is deadly. It's because kidney disease itself is deadly unless you get like a working kidney.
So talk me through the dialysis. How is that working?
Yeah. So there's a variety of ways to do it. Dialysis, it's a machine. So we should probably talk about the dialysis that people are probably most familiar with, which is dialysis, going to a dialysis clinic, and you're going there 3 times a week. You have to go 3 times a week. The kidneys work 24/7. So they're little, you can think of them as little machines, little organs that are doing filtration nonstop while you eat, while you exercise, while you sleep. They're doing their job. When they stop working, you're waiting until the next dialysis session to get that filtration. So when I tell patients, oh, I have to go 3 times a week, it's a lot. And it is a lot. You go in there and you're connected to a machine for about 4 hours each time. So think of it as a 4-hour plane ride where you're stuck in a seat. You can't really move, can't stand up, you can't stretch around too much. 3 times a week, you're taking a cross-country flight. And patients don't like the logistics of doing that. And I don't blame them. But the story just continues to get worse. So even if you do it, it's suboptimal because the 3 times a week, 4 hours, that's the only time where you're getting that clearance, that filtration. The rest, when you're off the machine, you're back to accumulating these toxins. And not all toxins are removed by dialysis. So some toxins just stay in your body forever, unfortunately, and those can cause. And we think those are the things that cause the problems that ultimately lead to death for 60% of people on dialysis.
So that machine is essentially, it is just for those 4 hours acting as your kidneys, and you're bypassing the kidneys and just filtering it through the machine.
Exactly. So it's suboptimal. So this is why we encourage people to get a transplant. But but not everyone can get it. You have to be a U.S. citizen.
Most people want it?
Most people do. Most people do want it. Some people don't. Some people don't want it because they're afraid of the surgery. Maybe they're a little bit older and they've had a good run and they say, you know, I've been through a lot of this. I don't want to go through more doctor's visits and all these things.
I'm assuming it comes at some cost to them. Is it covered?
If you have kidney failure in this country, there was a law passed about 50 years ago saying that you are entitled to insurance coverage through Medicare. You would get covered for dialysis. You have to be a U.S. citizen. There's some requirements to it. And then you would be eligible also for a transplant under this. However, in order to get a transplant, many centers do like you having a second insurance because not everything is covered, like some medications or insurance coverage runs out after about 3 years. So they want you to have additional insurance. And some people don't have the second insurance to cover all these other things too. So there's a little bit of cost too involved.
It's wild to think that you can take a kidney or any organ for that matter out of someone else, put it into another body, and it works. It's incredible.
It's extremely fascinating. Who gets it? Why? How we can reduce these... the difference between the need and the supply. It's extremely fascinating. But we should talk about the turn in course I've had in my career, which is the emphasis on treating people after the fact to, you know, preventing disease. Mm-hmm. You know, number two cause is diabetes and high blood pressure. Not only can you treat these diseases, you can prevent these diseases. And we think there's not good evidence, but you can maybe perhaps even reverse kidney disease in some situations by getting rid of the disease, or at least you can at least stop the loss. Stopping the loss can actually be all a person needs. If you have 50% kidney function, you're stage 3 kidney disease, many people live a life with that amount of kidney function.
Let's go through some of that.
Go
through some of these sort of lifestyle preventative measures one can explore to A, reduce their chance of getting chronic kidney disease in the first place.
Yeah.
Or B, if they have it, to sort of halt it, potentially even reverse it.
Yeah. So let's talk about preventing disease in the first place. So the things to prevent disease are the things that would prevent the risk factors for disease. So preventing diabetes and high blood pressure. So for diabetes, we know that eating a diet predominantly of healthy foods, which is a controversial subject these days, but most people would agree that these are foods that are minimally processed. They're whole foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, all these types of things. And then exercising. So maintaining a healthy weight, not eating too many calories, not smoking, all these things contribute to a healthy lifestyle and prevent the development of diabetes. And the same thing.
And hypertension.
And if you do have these diseases, we have good evidence that doing these things will treat the disease and maybe even lead to a reversal in some cases. For example, most people don't know for high blood pressure, the DASH diet was actually mostly plant-based. Original intentions of the DASH diet were to make it as plant-based or vegetarian as possible, but the only reason that they added animal products was to make it palatable to the general public. Some of the original studies actually coming out, the precursor studies for the DASH diet, actually came out of Australia. And those were only the result of researchers noticing that the people who had the lowest blood pressures in modern society were people who were eating these mostly plant-based diets. They called them, they were vegetarians, and they used another term, macrobiotic diet. But they were essentially eating plant-based diets, and these were people who had lower blood pressures. And that led to trials, and then ultimately led to the DASH diet. So for people who don't know, the DASH diet is a diet that was tested in the 90s to see if it lowers blood pressure. There's actually two trials done. They were both randomized controlled trials of about 450 people. And it was done for over a month. People were randomized to different arms. And the first trial looked at people who were eating this DASH diet, which was high in fruits and vegetables included, some low-fat dairy and some lean meats. And then it was compared to people on just a control standard American diet. And what it showed is that people eating a DASH diet had lower blood pressure. And in the second iteration of it, they included salt and they lowered salt. And lowering the salt also lowered blood pressure too. So when you combine eating a DASH diet, lowering your salt in people who have the higher blood pressures, so systolic around 150 to 160, these people actually were able to achieve a blood pressure reduction that was equal to one or two blood pressure medications just within 30 days, which is extremely impressive. So the number was 21 millimeters of mercury in the top number and then 9 millimeters of mercury in the bottom number. That's very impressive.
Hey friends, I hope you're enjoying this episode. It's Simon here. Just a quick intermission to remind you that my book, The Proof is in the Plants, is now available. In this book, I cover common myths about plant-based diets, evidence showing the potential health benefits that are up for grabs, the positive impact eating plant foods has on the planet, and much more. To order your copy, head to plantproof.com/book. plantproof.com/book. Okay, let's get back into it.
Yeah, the DASH diet is, if you look at most of the guidelines around the world where they talk about hypertension or blood pressure, the DASH diet, because of those studies, tends to come up quite regularly.
Yeah.
That's hypertension. And then diabetes, obviously, of course, there's a lot of science around diet and reversing, slowing down, preventing.
Yeah, so it depends on what you're looking for the evidence. But we can touch on all of these. So let me tell you why I say, as I was mentioning earlier, kidney disease is kind of an umbrella term. You can get kidney disease from different causes and they manifest in the kidney slightly differently. So say you have diabetes and at least kidney disease, we call that diabetic kidney disease. And we know from these studies done in people who had type 1 diabetes. And so if you have type 1 diabetes, your pancreas isn't making enough insulin. And there was a study, I think it was done in Italy about 10 or 20 years ago, and they gave people a pancreas transplant. So basically, they reversed their diabetes. So if you have type 1 diabetes, you have to take insulin, but you can also get a pancreas transplant. And getting a pancreas transplant, you get a healthy pancreas, and your pancreas makes all the insulin you need.
Wow. That's crazy. I have not heard that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that's coming from someone who's deceased.
Yeah, exactly. Someone who's deceased. I think you may be able to donate a part of your pancreas in some cases, like the cell-specific cells, but I'm not too sure about that. But going back to the study, what they did was that these people who had type 1 diabetes, they got a pancreas transplant and they had diabetic kidney disease from their type 1 diabetes. And after a transplant, they followed the health of their kidneys over time. And what they saw at 5 years on biopsies, you could start to notice changes in the kidney. And by 10 years, the diabetic kidney disease had been severely reduced, had essentially reversed because they have achieved a normal blood sugar levels in their bodies. So essentially, by treating the diabetes, they have reversed their diabetic kidney disease. So if that is possible with type 1 diabetes, we wonder if this is possible with type 2 diabetes. We know that if you eat healthy, you can get rid of your diabetes. You certainly improve it. there was a retrospective case series of people getting rid of their diabetes on a whole foods plant-based diet. Barnard showed in his 74-week trial that eating a plant-based diet was better than the American Diabetes Association diet. So there's studies showing that eating a plant-based diet full of fruits, vegetables, these healthy foods, it's good for you. And if you could reduce your diabetes, you can certainly temper the progression of your kidney disease. But if you can reverse your diabetes and maintain it for 10 years, it may be possible that you can reverse your diabetic kidney disease based on that one study. Again, it was a small study, just one study, but it does leave the box open. I think this is really important because prior to that study, people thought that this was a one-way street. Once you lost your kidney function, once you got that fibrosis from the diabetes, that you couldn't go back and reverse it. So this kind of opens the door as what can the body do? What's the body's healing ability?
You're sort of in the trenches and with patients all the time.
Yeah.
And no doubt giving this advice, right, to adopt a diet rich in these whole plant foods. A, how is that being received by the patients that you see?
Yeah.
And are you noticing changes in terms of these biomarkers that are indicative of the health of their kidneys?
Yeah, I definitely see changes. And not even the biomarkers. We see changes in the diabetes. We see changes in the blood pressure and the weight. Not to stereotype, I had a lady not too long ago who was the typical French person. She was drinking a lot of wine. She was smoking. She was eating a lot of unhealthy food, a lot of fatty foods, a lot of meats, a lot of cheeses. And she had diabetes, high blood pressure. She was obese. And I told her, you know, change. She had a little bit of protein in her urine too. I told her.
What does that mean when, I know you mentioned that before. What does that mean if you're showing protein in the urine?
Yeah, it's a good question. So that's another marker. So we talked about, so there's actually two markers to test to see if you have kidney problems. So one was the blood, the GFR, the creatinine. We talked about that. The other one is to see how your urine is. Is everything in your urine supposed to be there, and things not supposed to be there, not there? So it's, you know, you don't want it to, you know, you don't want to have protein, for example, in your urine. Protein is important for your body because it's used in muscle synthesis, important function. So if you're losing protein in your urine, that filtration barrier in your kidney, you can think of it as like a small sieve or a colander. That thing is broken and the protein is leaking through. So if you have protein in your urine, that's a sign that diabetes or perhaps blood pressure that you have may be damaging that filtration barrier, that very sensitive instrument. And then, you know, you're having this damage and having this problem that should be treated. And so it should be the underlying diseases. So going back to this lady, she had this and I told her about plant-based diet. I told her about eating healthy, stop smoking, cutting back on drinking. And I saw her next visit. And she was one of the most remarkable cases I've had. She lost 21 pounds within 3 months. Blood pressure was down. We had to cut back on her medications. Protein had improved. And she had literally turned her life around in that process. But not every patient is like that. There's a lot of, I work in a public hospital. There's a lot of factors that go into a person's ability to make those changes. Do they have the resources, the financial means? Working in a public hospital, you see a lot of people on the margins of society. They may not be a citizen. They may not speak English. They may not have the resources. They may not even have like enough money to take the bus fare to get to the hospital. So to tell them these things, it can be difficult.
Where is it as well as a priority for them as well in terms of everything else that's going on in their life?
And especially now with the coronavirus outbreak, it's difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where do you sit in terms of, I mean, by the sounds of what you're sort of describing there, this is very much about getting on top of diabetes, getting on top of hypertension through lifestyle modifications. What we're talking about here is change in the foods that you're eating. Where do you sit in terms of the low carbohydrate sort of ketogenic diet for people with diabetes? Because, I mean, there is an argument on one side of the fence that just by removing carbohydrates, you're going to get better blood glucose control. Do you see this as a dietary framework that could be of use with patients that have chronic kidney disease?
I have perhaps two passions. One has been understanding kidney disease and how diets affect that, but then also understanding fad diets and then the misinformation that it creates amongst people, because it ultimately undermines the work that many organizations and agencies do in trying to encourage people to eat fruits and vegetables, and a recurring fat diet that takes a different form every 5 to 10 years is these low carb diets. And the latest one to come around is the ketogenic diet. So if we step back and look at all diets, all types of diets for weight loss, what we notice is that it's not so much the diet that is important, is how much you adhere to the diet. And that's what we were talking about earlier, is that dietary adherence is very important. The ketogenic diet is one of the strictest diets out there, in that you're limited by the foods that you can eat, but you're so limited is that you have to be in ketosis for this ketogenic diet to work, if it does work. And when we look at the trials, the studies, short-term studies show people having these almost eye-popping results. They lose a lot of weight. Diabetes improves. I use quotes, air quotes. And then when you look
Why do you do that?
Well,
talk me through that. I know, but I'm sure the listeners want.
Yeah. This is like a trap. My inbox is going to get flooded by more people who were talking about that earlier. There's so many things I want to talk about right now, and it's hard to talk about them all at once. So people confuse carbohydrates. They confuse they confuse a banana with,
jelly beans.
Jelly beans, or like an apple with apple pie, or, they think carbs and they think bad, but apples and bananas are not causing insulin resistance and diabetes out there. These are foods that people have eaten for health for a long period of time in multiple societies, multiple periods of time, multiple places. And we have reached a point where people are fearing this. And Michael Greger wrote a book like 20 years ago, Carbophobia, alluding to this. And now it's come back again with the keto diet craze. And people who have diabetes are fearful when they eat any sort of carbohydrate because they see that their blood glucose goes up. And certainly if you eat an apple pie, your blood sugar will go up after you have a meal. But if you eat a banana, it may go up, but it won't go up as much as that apple pie. But because it went up a little bit, because there was a little bit of glucose in there, people are fearful. But what people don't understand is that over the long term, people who eat fruits and vegetables and eat these types of foods, they ultimately lose weight, they lose the fat, they become healthier, insulin resistance decreases, and they actually get better. But because people don't eat these foods, they're fearful, they're being told not to, people don't get better. And then people are now caught in this fake belief that their glucose is getting better because they're eating diets without carbs, but their underlying insulin resistance is still there. And then perhaps they're eating all these other foods like bacon or French fries or something else that maybe is unhealthy for them. And then they're putting themselves at risk for some other problem. Could be heart attack, stroke, cancer, kidney stones. So it could be any number of things. So going back to my original point, so if we think of
adherence, you were talking about
adherence.
Right? Yeah,
it should be a diet that is adherable, that one can adhere to. And then we should also look at what does that diet have as an added advantage over other diets. So if you're like going to buy a car and all cars are the same, they get you from point A to point B. What's the extra benefit of choosing this car over another car? And you can think of diets the same way. Reason plant-based diets, plant foods went out, your Mediterranean, flexitarian, vegetarian, vegan, whole food plant-based, these diets, these variations, the core of them is that they do have a lot of foods that are or are whole fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans. And then these foods have the added benefit of protecting you against kidney stones, heart attacks, strokes, cancer, list goes on and on. So you don't want to treat one problem and put yourself at risk for more problems and then, have to deal with those later. You want to kind of just like set it and forget it. Pick a diet that's healthy, and then that's the best insurance you have, best health insurance that you could buy.
Yeah. So essentially the ketogenic diet, you may be getting better blood glucose readings than you had previously on whatever diet you came from. But that is not necessarily the full picture and indicative of whether your long-term health outcomes will be improved.
Yeah, and we should talk about that. So when you look at those ketogenic diet studies, RCTs, randomized controlled trials, for a year. There's this meta-analysis by Bueno et al. And they do meta-analysis of these one-year trials of people on a low-carb diet versus a high-carb diet, which they control diet. And when you look at the one-year mark of people who are actually, the amount of carbohydrates they're actually eating, what you see is that most people for the studies that reported this information, they actually were not on a ketogenic diet. They were actually eating more carbs than is allowed on the ketogenic diet. So what does that tell you is that the diet is difficult to adhere to. And if they are eating those carbohydrates, then they probably are seeing those spikes in blood glucose.
And they're probably worse, right, per gram of carbohydrate because of how much saturated fat they're eating in the diet as well, right?
Exactly. There's a handful of studies showing perhaps worsening insulin resistance on people who are on a ketogenic diet. It's about three or four studies. There was the...
Kevin Hall showed that, I think.
Yeah, Rosenbaum study. There's another study by Neumau. There's another with Sweeney from like 100 years ago. But basically, and for people that have Robbie Barbero's Mastering Diabetes book, he talks about in that chapter, and so those studies are cited in there. So for anyone that wants to go track these studies down, basically what happens is that when you look at people who are eating a ketogenic diet, and then all of a sudden you give them a carbohydrate load or you give them a meal, these people have higher blood glucoses than people who are otherwise eating a non-high-fat diet. Some of those studies were ketogenic, some were not. But basically, the people eating the high-fat diets had what shows worsened insulin resistance. So when they got the carbohydrate load, blood sugars went up over someone who, say, was eating a lower fat content and a higher carbohydrate load and prior to that carbohydrate loading, which is really impressive.
I think that this is a really, really important point because a lot of the low-carb enthusiasts will say, oh, it doesn't matter if you're not going to eat carbohydrates again, right?
Yeah.
Just get into ketosis, stay in it. But what you're saying is these studies that are 1, maybe 2 years maximum, by the end, people are eating carbohydrates.
Yeah.
And what I really wonder is, right, you see a patient down at your clinic, that patient is a high likelihood that they're very different to the sort of 1% bubble of people doing keto on social media who are measuring their state of ketosis all day.
Yeah. Right?
And it's, we can get caught up in that side of things and lose focus on how practical is this diet for someone.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of factors that go into it. People want something new. They want something quick. They're looking for an easy solution. Some of these people have a financial interest in selling something, a supplement or a book or a philosophy. There's a lot of things that go into it. But at the end of the day, what it does is it undermines a core message of just eating more healthy foods, more fruits, more vegetables, more whole grains. And you don't have to agree with me on all the points for people listening out there, but these types of foods aren't really the cause, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, lentils, things like that. Mm. These are not the foods that are causing people to have high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. If people ate more of these, they would probably get themselves halfway there or even more.
Yeah. Yeah. So like what's your stance on, I guess, like a traditional Mediterranean diet?
It's definitely better than the standard American diet. If you're eating a traditional Mediterranean diet, you know, good for you. If you have problems because of it, health problems because of the choices you made over your lifetime, and that's what you're eating, then there may be room for improvement. Maybe you need to cut out the cheese or, you know, something, or eat more fruits or vegetables. But if we could get the standard American diet to be a Mediterranean diet, that would be a huge win for this country. Yeah, it would be a huge shift in the needle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back to chronic kidney disease, and I guess specific to those sorts of patients.
Yeah.
Talk to me about protein and if there is any sort of protein restriction that's required for these patients.
Yeah. So this is also slightly controversial. There's two camps. Some people who believe it's useful and some people who don't believe it's useful based on the information. There are some things that we know clearly that we can say firmly, like the DASH diet will help lower blood pressure. Eating more fruits and vegetables will help lower blood pressure. And there's some things where we don't have quite robust evidence, or maybe we need more evidence to kind of say clearly. And protein is one of those things. So I'll tell you what we know and what is out there. So if you don't have kidney disease, that's actually probably where the most uncertainty is. You sent me some studies last night. I took a look at them. A lot of studies are short in duration. So kidney disease can be a slow process. It can be extremely fast if you have uncontrolled diabetes. I've seen people drop 10% kidney function per year or even more and go on dialysis within a couple of years. But then you also have people who are just slowly, you know, trucking along, and they are the ones who, you know, they may need to think about this seriously, about needs for dialysis, maybe, you know, 20, 30 years. So progression can be variable. The cause of diseases can be variable. The studies that look at this are for people who are healthy are short. There's a short in duration. One of the studies you sent me, they're looking at people who are both eating high protein already in both arms. So one was eating, I think, 2.5 or something, and another one was eating 3.3.
Which is very high, 3.3 grams per kilogram.
Exactly. Yeah. And both of those are high by most definitions for people. Yeah. So we should probably take a moment to explain why this is relevant.
Yeah.
What's high?
Yeah, yeah.
Why
yeah.
are we talking about this?
Yeah, yeah. So let's start with why protein could even be an issue. You sort of mentioned earlier, you alluded to that filtering aspect.
Yeah. So when you eat protein, there is nitrogen in there. Some of that nitrogen gets used up and is a part of muscle synthesis, various important biological functions. Some of it gets metabolized into waste. And that waste needs to be excreted by the kidney, or you could go into a uremic coma. Bad things can happen. And so it's important that the kidney does this. So the kidney has the ability to increase function on a day-to-day basis. So if you eat a lot of protein, the kidney can do this through a process called hyperfiltration. So we're talking about filtration, but the term is actually called hyperfiltration. And then the kidney can increase the amount of filtering it does based on the needs. In this case, protein. Protein stimulates more blood flow to the kidney, more filtration happens, and you excrete these waste products. For people who have kidney failure or close to it, they can precipitate them going into a uremic coma or accumulating all these toxins and having bad things happen to them by eating a lot of protein. And through evolution, this has evolved as kind of like a mechanism. Some people say that this is a reason that, humans were destined to eat meat. But I argue against that, and I say this is actually seen in multiple species, rats, cats, dogs, frogs, not to rhyme, but it's just for all sources of protein, and it's just a mechanism to prevent from this, from accumulation of uremic toxins from happening. So at any rate, for people who don't have kidney disease, this may not be a problem. You eat a lot of protein, kidneys rev up, they go into hyperfiltration, you excrete these byproducts, they rev back down, you repeat.
Well, when you say a lot, what amount? I mean, the RDA is about 0.8 grams per kilo.
Right.
When you're talking about eating a lot.
Yeah. So the definition varies. So people start in the renal community, and the people who research, study, treat kidney disease, people define it starting at 1.2 grams per kilogram per day, all the way up to 2.0 grams per kilogram per day. The definitions vary based on, there's no consensus.
And then the bodybuilding community has a whole another set of...
I'm sure.
Yeah,
but most people seem to converge around 1.5.
Yeah.
And that one study when you sent me, the people were eating 2+ and then 3+ in each of the arms. So right off the bat, both of these groups were eating high protein diets, whether your cutoff is at 1.5 or 2.0. So what would have been nice to see normal protein. I don't want to say low protein. That for people who are in the renal community, that connotes a different set of numbers, but a normal protein amount, like the 0.6 to 0.8 you were talking about. And then another arm where you're eating more than two, and then compare those for a period of time. But what is adequate amount of time? What if this, you know, it takes, you know, 5 years for you to damage that, and then you have this decline?
So the theory that your theory is, why overwork it if you don't need to?
So that's probably the safest, you know, line to stick to. If you know your needs are 1.5, don't do 3.5 grams per kilogram per day, because you just don't know. So
is there a difference between animal protein and plant protein in terms of this filtration process in the kidney?
We think there is. The study is limited. There's this one study by Contessis, and they looked at it for about 4 weeks. People eating animal protein had more of this hyperfiltration effect than people eating plant protein. And that's really all we know. We think that plant protein causes the same effect in revving up the kidneys. It's protein, has nitrogen, these wastes can accumulate. People do think that eating plant foods, even though they do contain protein, causes less accumulation of toxins compared to animal protein. There's some data showing that based on changes in the microbiome and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, and you and I were speaking sort of off air, I think last night, even if your goals were different and you're looking at muscle protein synthesis, for example, the research on that seems to conclude that there's a bit of a ceiling anyway. So I think it's like 1.6 grams per kilo.
Yeah,
is a ceiling of when someone is essentially maximizing the amount of muscle protein synthesis they would get. So anything above that is, in their sort of bodybuilding world, considered an insurance policy buffer, but probably isn't contributing to the muscle protein synthesis itself.
Right, yeah.
So that's just some interesting context to sort of feed into this.
Yeah, exactly. And you were talking about maybe if you're eating plant protein, should you add like a little bit of 10% buffer because of
bioavailability?
So yeah, that seems fine. I don't know what the exact number is. We don't even have good studies based on just animal protein. So they're going to plant protein, and this issue for kidney disease, it's we're treading into uncertain waters. But if it's not getting absorbed, you know, the effect of the kidney is not going to happen. So that's for people who don't have kidney disease. So when we start talking about people with kidney disease, maybe half the community, I don't know, many nephrologists do agree that you definitely shouldn't overdo it because of that hyperfiltration aspect. So if you have a kidney that's injured, you have kidney disease, causing that hyperfiltration can cause more damage.
And speed up that progression potentially between the stages.
Exactly. There's some evidence that for people with diabetes that can happen. There's some evidence for people who are spilling a lot of protein in their urine that can happen. So there's actually been studies to show what happens when you actually cut back on the amount of protein that you're taking in and how that affects kidney disease. There was a big study done, and this study actually came out as a negative study, meaning that they showed no difference. But then there's a secondary analysis of that study. This is the MDRD study. And what it showed is that people who cut back on their protein reduce that hyperfiltration, meaning that you lose that little bit of kidney function that, you know, can kick in as needed. But then afterwards, after a point of 3 years, the loss of kidney function did slow down. So there is a small benefit. How big or small depends on the person and their diet and all of these things, but there definitely is not no benefit. There definitely is some benefit. So for people with kidney disease, we tell people certainly don't do 3.5 grams of protein per day.
Practically speaking, I'm guessing you're not so much telling your patients, or maybe you are, how many grams per kilo, or are you more saying, hey, have about this size serving of beans or legumes or whatever it is once or twice a day? Like how do you sort of navigate this protein conversation with a patient?
Yeah, so you tell them to eat healthy sources of protein, a lot of beans. And then it becomes even more complex when you start factoring into acid, because the kidneys buffer the acid load that people eat, phosphate levels. So you have to watch out on where they're getting it. So some tofu variations have more phosphate than others. So you have to follow levels. Phosphate's not reported on many of the on labels, period, in the United States. There's a push to change that. So we tell people, to eat more lentils, beans, tofu, your healthier proteins like that. The other aspect for people who do have kidney disease, the other reason to eat a plant-based diet is because of these added benefits. So plant foods have natural alkali in them, which is good because in kidney disease, you cannot buffer the acid you're eating. Much of the acid that is generated comes from the diet. And a lot of the acid comes from things like cheeses, meats, things like that. So when people who have kidney disease eat these foods, you'll notice that on the blood work, the bicarbonate level, the CO2 level is low. And that is reflective of an accumulation of acid in the blood. So for these people, they have to take literally bicarbonate to neutralize that acid. You may not be familiar with bicarbonate, but bicarbonate is commonly sold as baking soda, sodium bicarbonate.
Yeah.
People put it in the fridge, they use it in baking. But that baking soda is bicarbonate, and you can take it to neutralize the acid. For people with healthy kidneys, you don't have to worry about this. Kidneys do all the work, and that's one of the beauties of the kidney. It does all this without your input or your awareness. But when you run into problems, then you have to pay attention to these things. The other thing is that with plant-based diets is that they do contain phosphate, but the phosphate is actually difficult to absorb because they're bound to this thing called phytate. And humans lack the enzyme to digest phytate. So people eating the standard American diet have an accumulation of phosphate when they have kidney disease, and they have to take these giant pills to bind the phosphate so it doesn't get absorbed. People eating plant-based diets can reduce those, the amount of phosphate being absorbed, because the phosphate just never gets absorbed naturally because they don't have this enzyme to break down phytate, which is interesting. So there's like, when you look at diets just in general, not for diabetes or obesity or even kidney disease, it's what else, what's the bonus benefit of that diet? You know, we always think about, okay, diet for weight loss, diet for obesity, diet for kidney disease, but is it giving you your maximum bang for your buck?
Yeah. While we're talking about phytates, that reminds me to talk about oxalates.
Oh, right. Right.
Because I think, I mean, perhaps there's some listeners, but I'm sure you've come across this before with kidney stones in particular.
Yeah.
And people wanting or being told to eat low oxalate foods. Is this something to be concerned of in terms of the plant-based diet can be rich in oxalates? Is that a concern for someone with chronic kidney disease? And are kidney stones something that someone with chronic kidney disease would get?
Yeah, so it's a complex subject and something to think about. What is told is people who have kidney stones should avoid all oxalates. The oxalates you eat and their effect on kidney stones is highly variable. And it depends on a lot of things. It depends on the other foods that you're eating. It depends on your microbiome. And it depends on hydration. All these things affect whether or not you get a kidney stone. It's like a chemistry experiment. Changing one variable can affect it, but there's also other variables that you are doing unconsciously that can also affect whether or not you get a kidney stone. The average person eating foods, reducing the oxalate does not, amount of oxalate you take in. So there are certain foods that contain a lot of oxalate, like spinach, rhubarb, nuts, chocolate. Some of these foods, if you do them in excess, you can increase the amount of oxalate. It is in your urine and cause a stone. If you're eating them in usual quantities, like you're having a mixed salad, there's a little bit of spinach in there, you shouldn't go out of your way to cut out the spinach unless you've been formally tested and you know that you have an extremely high amount of oxalate in your urine. Eating spinach or chocolate or rhubarb or a little bit of star fruit every now and then, star fruit is extremely high. So unless you're doing it every day, three times a day, then you can put yourself into trouble. For the average person, these foods are part of a balanced diet and you should eat them. Just don't overdo it. So the people that get kidney stones, the case reports, these are people who are doing like spinach only in their salads. They're doing spinach only in their smoothies.
Like a bag of spinach in the smoothie.
Bag or two. And they're doing it three times a day. And then of course they got a kidney stone. Yeah, if you did, you know, anything, you would get, you know, some problem overdoing it. People use it as another weapon to like scare people away from like plant foods and say, oh, these
foods. Well, it's an anti-nutrient is what it would get labeled
as. Yeah. Yeah. Anti-nutrient. But what we're learning, and this is only recently, this is the subject of my research here at NYU, is the amount of oxalate you eat can actually feed bacteria in your gut who ultimately degrade that oxalate. So it may not even make it into your urine. There's a bacteria called Oxalobacter formigenes, and it lives on oxalate and oxalate only. So if you take more oxalate, presumably you'd have more of this bacteria in your gut, and perhaps that you won't have more oxalate in your urine. We're still learning a lot about it. It's, you know, the microbiome is new. We're learning all the nuances to it. This is a facet off the microbiome that's just emerging and we're looking into. So that may be one reason why when people adjust the amount of oxalate that they eat in their diet, that it doesn't change as much as we would expect in their urine. And that may be why. The other reason is that if you're taking in of foods that are that have calcium in them, like dark, leafy, lean vegetables, they may be binding with the oxalate, and then you may not even get it absorbed. And then fat also plays a role in this too. So if you're eating a lot of fat, the fat binds to the calcium in your gut, and then oxalate gets absorbed. But if you don't eat a lot of fat, then maybe that calcium is free in your gut to bind oxalate. So like I said, it's a chemistry experiment. And it depends on the other variables too. It's like asking like if a plane will crash, but you need to know all the where it's going, the speed, all these things to know what will happen. It's kind of the same way with the stone. But what I will tell you with kidney stones is that for the most part, there are some things that we can all take away from. I've had a kidney stone myself. About 10, 12% of people will have kidney stones, especially men. Women, it's a little bit lower at some point in their lives. If you had a kidney stone, it'll happen again.
What are the symptoms of that?
Pain.
Yeah.
Intense, excruciating pain.
And what's the management?
The management varies. If you've had a bad one, you might need a procedure to get the stone out. You may need to get it destroyed. But if you have a small one, like I did, it may pass on its own. People say, oh, you know, Dr. Joshi, he had a kidney stone. He eats a plant-based diet. I shouldn't eat it. I shouldn't eat a plant-based diet. I'll have a kidney stone. I actually had a kidney stone when I was not on a plant-based diet. I was in high school. I was thinking about trying out for a football team. Coach said, oh, you need to gain some weight so we can put you on. You're this tall, lanky guy. So he was like, oh, eat a bunch of these TV dinners. Have a lot of protein, a lot of fat. You'll gain some weight. We can maybe put you on. So that's what I did. I ate a lot of these TV dinners. They're actually horrendous for
TV dinner.
TV dinner are those dinners in the frozen section that you buy and you eat in front of your TV. You put them in the microwave. You know, they have like maybe chicken or something, a meatloaf, mashed potatoes, corn.
Bet you they've been cleared out this week because the frozen food section's been decimated.
They've been decimated. Everything's been decimated. Decimated by the fear of coronavirus.
There's a lot of TV food dinners in New York right now. Hopefully not too many kidney stones off the back of this.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, so I ate a lot of that and that gave me a kidney stone. It was only until years later that I realized why that would give me a kidney stone when I was studying, you know, as a nephrology fellow. So those foods are extremely high in sodium. And they're also, at the time, I was not plant-based, so I was eating a lot of animal protein. Those two things, eating a lot of salt and a lot of animal protein, contributes to the formation of a stone. The sodium contributes to it because when you eat more sodium, you have more salt or sodium in your urine, and that causes more calcium in your urine. They go hand in hand. And that the calcium ultimately forms the calcium oxalate stone, which is a stone type of stone most people have. And then eating a lot of animal protein, there's a lot of acid in it, which we talked about earlier, which was important for people with kidney disease. But it's relevant for people who don't have kidney disease because you can get a stone. That acid forms the right pH for the formation of a calcium oxalate stone. And then you can get a stone that way. And the third thing being that I was in Florida, which is hot. Warm, wasn't drinking enough water. So
hydration.
Yeah. So two liters per day for everyone.
There you go, guys.
Yeah.
No excuses. No kidney stones. Not in the plant-proof community.
Exactly.
Hey friends, me again. Quick note to let you know, I have a brand new, completely complimentary 2-week plant-based meal plan on my website. Inside contains delicious breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack recipes, along with a complete breakdown of the nutritional information for each. Whether you're looking to add one plant-based meal to your weekly regime or go full plant, I'm sure you'll find this resource helpful. You can get your copy today at plantproof.com/meal plan. That's plantproof.com/meal plan. Okay, let's get back into it.
It's a little bit ironic, I guess, that you had a kidney stone and then have ended up being a nephrologist. You said that when you developed the kidney stone, you weren't yourself eating a plant-based diet. So talk me through what your personal journey was like, why you changed the way that you ate in the first place.
Yeah, so I had that kidney stone in high school, and kidney stones are not something that inspire people to become a nephrologist. I haven't met anyone that became a nephrologist after having a kidney stone. They're they're extremely painful and you just want to avoid all association with them ever again.
But it put them on the radar, I guess.
Yeah.
You're aware of them.
I am. You will be aware of it if you have one. Boy, the people around you will take notice too. What got me on this path was in medical school, I received a lecture from the founder of the South Beach Diet. And he gave his lecture to the medical students. And he said that he emphasized eating wild game, and that the reason many of the health diseases people have is because we're eating a lot of processed food, which is true, but we're also eating meat that is not the meat that it was before during human evolution.
Not the woolly mammoth.
Yeah. And so we should go back to eating wild game. And this combination of eating fruits, vegetables, unprocessed food, and wild game is optimal for human health. And that struck a chord with me for a variety of reasons. I started looking into it, and it bothered me enough that I felt like I had to do something.
And at that point in time, your diet was like a standard
American diet. I had been vegetarian on and off, and at that point, I think I was not vegetarian. And I was vegetarian for cultural reasons, as being an Indian American. My mother is vegetarian. A lot of my relatives are. But as many people who migrate to this country, and then especially second, third generation members of those migrants, we adopt the culture of their host country. So I had become Americanized, and I was eating, Pizza Hut and McDonald's and all this garbage.
What did your mother think about that?
no comment. Yeah. but someone telling me that I had to eat meat for optimal health struck a chord, because when I was vegetarian, I didn't feel like I was wasting away or I was dying. And certainly, millions of people in India are vegetarian, and you don't see them in protein deficient states, unless they don't have enough tea, which is another problem in India. So I started looking into this, and I've always been interested in what human evolution and what the past has to hold. Jurassic Park was an extremely fascinating movie growing up, and I majored in biology in college. And I for a time, I even thought, oh, maybe, being a paleontologist would be cool. I think we all had that feeling after seeing Jurassic Park. So I just started looking at papers and looking into the research and seeing if we needed to eat meat. Did we eat meat? Did meat make us human? And a lot of the things that people say at the time in Miami, paleo diet was all the rage. That was like the thing. That was the iteration of the low carb diet that was raging back then. This is like 10, 12 years ago, around the time of the last stock market crash. And at that time, this was the variation of the low carb diet that people thought was optimal for health. So I looked into it. I accumulated a lot of literature, and at the time, I thought I would write a book. But the wave came and gone, and I also went into residency. I just never had the time to get that information out there. So now that I'm 10 years wiser, I like to think, with the keto diet, I feel the need to get that information out there. But to answer the points regarding,
what did you unearth?
Yeah, so we ate meat in human evolution. That is unquestionable. But we only ate it out of necessity. It wasn't that meat made us human. We ate it because it was a calorie source. And people say we've been eating meat for millions of years, but I don't think that's accurate, because we had to have tools to get the meat. People go hunting now, and they go hunting with a gun, and they have all this equipment and stuff, and they may not find or shoot anything or kill anything for days on end. Imagine if you were in prehistoric times, you didn't have, your equipment, you didn't have a gun. All you had, was you, no maps, no nothing. And you were out there with whatever primitive tools you had. It's extremely difficult to acquire animal protein on your own. The only reason it's commonplace now is that we've industrialized this process and made it extremely efficient. But if you go back then, the tools just didn't exist. We have evidence of spears, which we think may have been the start of when people might have been able to actually subdue a woolly mammoth or a large mammal or something to provide sufficient protein source dating back to maybe 400,000 years ago. So not millions of years. And humans...
Is that around the time of discovery of fire? I know that that's still argued as well when that was.
Yeah, so people say maybe now it's 800,000 years ago when fire was. But when was fire mastered? You know, when was fire commonplace? Because, okay, so you acquire this animal. How do you not get diseases from eating raw meat? When you look, so raw meat is actually one of the things that stimulates a strong response of disgust. So Paul Rosen, who is this famous food psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, that's where I did my fellowship in nephrology. He talks about disgust, like what triggers people to have this intense emotion to avoid things. Raw meat is up there with like bodily fluids. And that may have an evolutionary mechanism that if you're avoiding raw meat, it may be a benefit because you're not getting the diseases. We tell, you know, in society now, we tell people avoid raw meat. Don't get E. coli. Don't get salmonella. The same thing might have happened there. They didn't understand hygiene. You could have picked it up from the soil. You could have picked it up from the gut of these animals that were being killed. So I feel like fire would have been important in that, making it safe, and then also making it digestible and chewable. I just don't see us, you know, bending over and eating out of a mammal like a cat. So if you understand the timeline of when these tools became around, you can start to see that we only started eating meat in sufficient quantities rather late in human evolution. So these spears occurred only around 400,000 years ago. But even then, some people have described them in the literature as just giant toothpicks, and that your risk of being injured would actually have been greater than the risk of you injuring the animal. And when they look at these skeletons from these our ancestors, they see a pattern of injury that's similar to rodeo riders, meaning that that going to hunt an animal, especially a large animal, would have been a risky proposition. Forget getting to the animal. You could have gotten lost. You could have injured yourself in the process. You maybe got dehydrated. Maybe you picked up an illness. You cut yourself. There was no first aid. And then you find the animal. Now you're tasked with killing it with a suboptimal tool, a suboptimal weapon. And based on fracture patterns and injury patterns on these skeletons, this would have been a risky proposition. The other thing people don't realize is that there's actually been a book called Man the Hunted. It's a fascinating book. And what it talks about is that actually man wasn't the hunter. Back then, our ancestors were actually being hunted. We weren't the top of the food chain.
Not the aggressor.
Yeah. We were being hunted by saber-toothed tigers. There's even an aspect, there was a skeleton with a hole in its skull where this giant eagle grabs the skeleton and likely lifted the small child or small ancestor up and devoured it or killed it. So we also faced our own dangers ourselves. So venturing out to hunt something else put us at risk too. So effective tools for hunting likely didn't occur like bows and arrows, spear throwers, other things likely didn't occur until later in human evolution, maybe 100,000 years ago. And by that time, modern humans were pretty much evolved. Human evolution was done. If we did eat animal protein beforehand, it was only out of necessity to supplement calories. It didn't necessarily turn us into carnivores. And some people say that there's a lot of things that could have made us human, and maybe it's an amalgam of those things. Maybe it was from us moving from ape-like movements like to bipedal locomotion. Maybe it was speech or something else, the acquisition of fire. But
fire as well would also arguably unlock not just meat, but also like tubers and stuff too.
Exactly.
Any calorie dense food.
Exactly. And there's actually papers and books written about it and how tubers would have been an important part. They would have been a more reliable source of calories. So when you think about hunting is very variable. There's no reliability in it. And if you need to survive, you need reliability. So when some of these anthropologists looked at the success rates of hunting, and it's on the order of like 10%. What is 100% or close to or higher is, you know, finding tubers. They're always in the ground. You can always find them. You can always eat them. You know, you don't have to depend on migration or luck or things like that. Well, to an extent you do, but not as much. So a lot of societies, especially in human evolution, had a few fallback foods. could be like a nut or a tuber. And then you also had a lot of other foods that you would eat. But the bulk of these foods for most societies was actually plant foods.
Am I right in saying that some of the sort of animal calorie protein consumption perhaps has been inflated by the fact that when you go to an archaeological site, you can easily see bone remains, but it's much harder to see the sort of fiber remains?
Exactly. We're getting a skewed picture. We're overlooking perhaps what our ancestors used to eat on a daily basis for the bulk of their calories. And that's unfortunate. It's easy to see these pictures of hunter-gatherers, and it really should be gatherer-hunters, but we term it that. Popular images show like a caveman, you know, eating a deer or something like that. But the reality, it was probably much different.
Yeah. I mean, even some of the guys, I think, that founded the paleo diet, there's a few studies I've read where they have concluded that through their research, they now believe the average fiber intake was around 100 grams.
Right,
day,
exactly.
Which is a lot. That's a lot of plant matter.
It's a lot of plant matter. They've gone on to revise that the bulk of calories should be coming from plant sources, but the cat was out of the bag at the time. People went on to thinking, they need to get bison.
Yeah, well, I mean, any paleo website, the first banner you see is usually some big caveman-looking guy with, you know, bow and arrow or some meat.
Exactly. And we overlook the less glamorous aspect of gathering. And female anthropologists have actually written that even the field of anthropology is sexist itself, is that it overlooks the contributions of female through all of humanity.
And their kids doing all the gathering.
Exactly. So it's kind of there's a lot of issues at play. Gender, food, diet, culture, all these things are intertwined. Some people have even gone on to say that, okay, so maybe we couldn't hunt, we didn't hunt, but maybe we scavenged and we like looked for carcasses and we got that. But that, I feel like that is such a crazy proposition that I wouldn't go up to a lion eating its meal or afterwards to scare it off so I could eat a deer. And now I'm supposed to imagine that my ancestors did that, especially in light of the bacteria on the mounds of these carnivores and then the bacteria within the prey itself.
Yeah. I mean, all this speaks back to food scarcity, right? If someone's doing that, and like you said, this would have been a highly risky business.
Yeah.
It suggests that it's like a worst case. Okay, guys, there's not enough calories around. We have to do this.
Yeah.
And you're sort of having your hand forced.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe for cultured societies, especially as the tools got better, they may have gone hunting and anthropologists talk about the cultural significance of hunting. They would tell stories forever. It would be a marker of when someone would become a man, things like that. But I feel like that probably only happened later in human evolution and not earlier. But yeah, it was just a different world and it's hard to understand the scarcity, the risks, all these aspects that go into it, the difficulty.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, so all of these things come back to the main point, which is that if you combine health literature, trials, observational, things that we learned in the lab, things that we know from evolution, all of these things kind of converge that the optimal diet for health is the one that is largely whole foods, plant-based. It doesn't involve ice cream and pizzas and candy bars and fried food or, you know, even buffalo bison.
Well, Shivam, thank you very much for joining me. I've certainly loved sitting down with you. I've learned a lot about chronic kidney disease and kidneys in general. Before we close this one out, is there anything that you think we missed?
Well, thanks for having me. The pleasure was mine. I really enjoyed this as well. Anything that we missed?
What about future research? What would you like to see in the next 5 years in this space? If you could, I know you just mentioned then some research you're doing on the microbiome, but broadly speaking, if you could set up and investigate any aspect of this area of medicine, what would it be?
I think we need to start doing these bigger trials. It's not what I want. It's what these camps want, the opposite opinion. So they say, you know, there's not a whole lot of evidence to not do a low carb diet, or there's not a whole lot of evidence supporting eating, you know, fruits and vegetables for diabetes. So what I think, and this is kind of like a pipe dream, but having, you know, maybe a trial of a lot of people for a good number of time, and then randomizing them to a whole food plant-based diet versus maybe like a low carb diet and seeing what these outcomes are.
And having patients with diabetes, but also patients with chronic kidney disease.
Yeah. It would have to be a big study.
Yeah. I mean, they may say that there's limited studies, but there are randomized controlled trials, as we spoke about before, looking at people with diabetes and plant-based diet.
Yeah, there are. And then to compare them against low-carb diets, maybe.
Yeah.
But some people are starting to venture into that space, like Kevin Hall.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah.
To see what happens.
Exactly.
All right. Well, maybe we'll sit back down when some further research comes out and we can chat about what takes place between now and then, and we can get an update on Corona as well.
Yeah, post-coronavirus apocalypse.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure was mine.
Well, there we go, friends. A new area of medicine explored. Please connect with Dr. Joshi on social media at sjoshimd on Instagram and let him know how this one landed for you. And finally, a parting question for each of you. Did you know when you're born, you start out with 4 kidneys, but lose 2 of them growing up? They turn into adult knees. Sorry, that's a terrible dad joke, and I hope a few of you got that. If you're enjoying the show, please do leave a review on Apple iTunes. I love reading them, and it only takes 1 or 2 minutes. Perhaps don't review my jokes. Next week, I bring you environmental researcher Nicholas Carter as we deep dive into climate change, planetary health, and how on earth our everyday food choices affect this great big blue spinning ball that we call home. This is a conversation I've been yearning to have for a long time. Nicholas and I are regularly sharing new studies online and making sense of things. And I really do believe he is one of the very best people that I can bring you to break down what is a very complex and often polarizing area of the food and diet conversation. So if you want to hear a deep dive on planetary health, the various myths out there about certain forms of agriculture, how we can reduce our environmental footprint, and what happens if we don't, then make sure to pencil this upcoming episode into your diary, and I shall see you there. Well, we made it to the end. Thanks for sticking with me. And as always, I look forward to meeting you back here soon. Bye for now, friends.